So the topic for today is refuge in the Sangha. And the way we've set up this retreat, it goes a little bit together with the insight that we're going to talk about in 3 days, which is insight into not-self. And it's a wonderful juxtaposition, this idea of not-self, whatever that might mean, and community. And perhaps there's a way that these are integrally related, that not-self is not the denial of community, but community is actually a very important foundation for the insight into not-self. And that our community life is very important. Sangha life is very important. And many of the challenges we have with this whole self thing, who we are and how we see ourselves, how we understand ourselves, a lot of the challenges in that have come from our lives in our communities. We acquire all kinds, we understand ourselves, to a great degree we understand ourselves in relationship to our community. We understand ourselves as we grow up in the way that we're treated by our family and people around us and what we see, how to be a human being and what kind of behavior is validated and all kinds of things. And then as we grow up, we get all these experiences and some of them which are wonderful and some of them which are quite challenging. In terms of my spiritual life, I was sent to a boarding school for a while. And it was in a very high up mountain area. And it was a very tough school, it turned out to be. The reform school I didn't know that when I was going to go there, but it turned out to be the reform school of all the other boarding schools. And it was this beautiful setting, and I was about, I think I was 15, and I was walking with an older kind of person, student, 17-year-old. And we were walking on this beautiful mountain road, and beautiful vista of the mountains and snow-capped mountains and valley below or stuff like that. And I looked around and marveled at all, and I said, "Why are we here? What's all this about?" And he said something like maybe worse than, "Don't be silly." And you know, this tender time, 15 or something, and kind of the beginning of this kind of like where are we? What's our place in this universe? And this awe and this wonder and this question. And to have it at that moment, this kind of shut down, you know, I closed up. And part of me closed up for a good number of years before that would open up again. So, you know, those kinds of stuff, that's a community experience that didn't work very well for me. And so the Dharma is here to help us open up and free ourselves from the ways that we've closed down or the burdens of ideas about who we are, who we should be, or who we shouldn't be, and all these opinions, ideas, stories that we create that somehow reflect back on ourselves that lack deep respect, deep valuing, deep care for ourselves, deep love. But community life can also be liberating. Community life can be, we can learn some of the best values, some of the when people appreciate us and see us as being respect-worthy and valuable, especially growing up as children, then we feel with that that's the case. And we can grow up with that as part of who we are. But if we don't grow up that way, it's going to be hard. And then, I remember when I was doing my first retreat in Thailand, I kind of a little bit stumbled onto this Vipassana center and said, I'm here to do whatever you have to tell me to do for until my visa comes to go back to Japan. And that was part of the short story is that after 10 weeks, I realized my visa wasn't coming. So my first Vipassana retreat like this was 10 weeks long, sitting and walking, sitting, walking. And so that was kind of fun. And but I was, so I'm here to do whatever you have to tell me. To, you know. And so he said, okay, you go out in that little hut on the edge of the swamp and go across these planks of wood that are on the swamp to get up to your little hut on stilts and sit and walk all day and come see me, the abbot said, every day. So I did. And then, and I was, I'd been a Zen student. I knew about discipline. And so I was kind of disciplined doing it intensely. And I had never practiced alone before this kind of way. So I realized, oh, now I have, the discipline has to be internal. In Zen, I kind of relied on the community for the discipline. So that was a wonderful lesson. And at some point during those 10 weeks, I don't know how long, maybe a few weeks in, I decided to take a break. And what that entailed was going for a walk around the monastery, kind of like clearly not following the schedule of sitting and walking. So I was kind of just going to stroll around the monastery. It was kind of a little bit like a dog patch kind of place. It's kind of like a little chaotic and anarchistic. And so I was just walking, started walking around. And lo and behold, who should walk by at that point but the abbot? And in my mind, I was supposed to be the serious, practitioner who always followed the schedule, never took a, never went walking around. So I was kind of mortified to be caught, kind of breaking the rules or something. And we were walking perpendicular to each other. So I was walking one way. He was walking in front of me, kind of passing me by. And he looked at me. And he kept walking. And the way he looked at me made such a huge difference for me. It's like it's changed something inside of me. On one hand, I felt like I'd never seen this way before by anyone so thoroughly, clearly could see me. At the same time, I felt he saw right through me. And he had no judgments about me that I'd broken the rules. He just like accepted me as I was and didn't require any raised eyebrows or anything. And somehow something inside of me kind of dropped when I saw that happen. Some kind of negative self-judgments, some idea that I had to live up to other people's, expectations of me or something. It was, I don't know if I described it well, but it was quite a moment. And that reminds me of the time that my friend and I, when we were 14, decided to go for a little ride with my father's car, but we didn't know how to drive. And right next to his little car was a bulldozer. So I think the car traveled about a foot and a half from where it was parked into the bulldozer. So I had to call him up. I said, Dad, we crashed your car into the bulldozer. And he just kind of like phoned, very matter of fact, said, was there any damage? And I said, well, we can't open the right-hand door of the car. And he said, okay, well, see what you can do about it, and I'll look at it when I come home. And that's the last I ever heard of it. And there was something about that I felt mortified. I felt remorse. I felt all kind of, he probably heard all that. But he just didn't get angry. He didn't shame me or get upset with me. And I think there was no need to do that. But to be seen, I felt like I was seen and understood. And I was corrected by my mistake. But that also made a huge impression on me. Well, that's a way to accept people. That's a powerful way to I didn't feel like he was ignoring the fact that I had crashed his car. He was doing something a higher order, some greater value than being upset or angry or criticizing me. And anyway, I don't know if that was articulate enough, but I'm trying to kind of give you some examples of, at least in my life, of how both how I got closed and were hurt by all kinds of people. I mean, I have a long list I can give you. Gil's biography of how he was hurt. And then a shorter list of Gil's biography of how I benefited from, you know, how people treated me and were with me. And so this community life of ours. So the Buddha's life, community was quite important. Or you see that if you read his story, you find it kind of the community is like in Sangha, the monastic community is always kind of close by, part of it. But his first kind of on his quest for awakening, there's a very interesting story of that he tells of going to study with two great meditation masters of his time. But when he goes and studies with them, he first learns their teachings. And he says, I learned their teachings thoroughly. And my teacher said he knew, and he could know, he knew intimately, he knew for himself, and he could see for himself these truths. I learned the teaching, and to remember, he's learning a teaching, a doctrine, and I claimed to have known and seen. And others in our group claimed they knew and see. So he's part of a community, a group of people who are probably diligent and serious students of the teacher, but they took in the teaching, the words, and confused that with seeing and knowing for themselves. And they believed because they understood the doctrine, that was the same as knowing and seeing. And then he did that with both teachers, and then he decided, no, that's not the way. The teachers are teaching meditation, and that's how they came to know and see. So let me do that as well. So he did that. He went and meditated, and he attained the meditation states that his teachers taught. And he thought, he came to it, and he said, well, no, actually, this is not what I was looking for. This doesn't help. And what he said he was looking for, one of the things he said he was looking for, he was looking for something wholesome. The word is kusala, sometimes translated as skillful. That's a word that's intimately connected to how people relate to each other. Often we think that the Buddha was searching for enlightenment, something very personal. But he's also looking for something kusala, and kusala could be translated into English as ethical. So he came into a community. The community was a little bit deluded about the truth. They thought it was enough just to believe, not to experience it for themselves. And then he went off and practiced, and did see and know for himself the truth, found what was skillful, ethical, found his awakening. And the idea that his awakening, his enlightenment, is an ethical awakening, places that experience of liberation in the context of community. Because ethics has a lot to do with how we treat each other. And I can't underscore enough how intertwined in his teachings is that the whole path to enlightenment, and enlightenment itself, is an ethical transformation that's often not discussed. It's such a strong, maybe individualistic emphasis that many people have about the enlightenment being this personal kind of transformation. But it also transforms how we live in the world with others. And I kind of like the idea that the first thing he did after he was enlightened, one of the first things was consider who he can go teach this. He got so much benefit from his understanding then who could he teach this to? And he wanted to go teach his two meditation teachers, but they had already died. And then he went, I said, well, there was a group of five of us, or six of us, five others, who were ascetics together with me. They helped me, they provided me with lots of help when he was an ascetic. And now they'll understand. So he went to find them. And he did a long walk across northern India to find them. And the idea that his impulse after his enlightenment was to go find this community he'd spent time with, the group of six, the five people, and teach them. I kind of find that very touching, very, very to the point, and very, speaks to this idea of community and the importance of it. And then he created a monastic community, the Sangha. And the tradition says there was two Sanghas that grew up, and Sangha refers to first the two things. It does refer to the monastic community. It also refers to the community of people who have had some taste of this awakening, this transformation, who know it for themselves. And whether they're lay or monastic, they're all the Sangha if they have that maturation of the practice. And he created these communities of people around him that he created and supported and guided and cared about. So it is important and valuable. But community is complicated and difficult. And Buddhist communities are difficult because it's not like all your best friends come together to make the community. It's people you never choose to spend time with on your own, and suddenly you're together in this community, and often the people, there's all kinds of social complexities in the Buddhist community. And I like to think of it, it's kind of by design, that's part of the training, that's part of the learning how to be in community, learning have yourself reflected in community, and you reflecting others, and you supporting others, being supported by others, being irritated by others, you irritating them, and everyone working it out and finding a way. And a strength of a Sangha, a Buddhist community, is not that there is no conflict, but that there's a healthy dedication to work out the conflict. One that's done with respect and care for each other, and to take the time to really figure out what is this. So this community is one of the refuges, one of the things that offers a sense of protection. But how does that work? And how do I talk about it on the third full day of a retreat, the middle of a retreat, so it's not agitating for you and gives you a lot to think about, but actually does the opposite, helps you to get calmer and feel like, oh, here's something that helps me feel, at ease. I can relax and let go and really feel like now I can really get deeper into my meditation practice, because something about understanding about community lets something go. Many times it's the opposite, that something about community and community dynamics will make people anxious and upset and closed and cautious and agitated. And so how do we understand this so that it's the opposite? And what is it about a Sangha, this idea of Sangha, that it makes it a refuge for us, that supports us in this kind of setting in at ease for us? So there, in the time of the Buddha, the monastic community was not always well behaved, and there's lots of stories in these that survive of the challenges of these monastic communities and getting along, and some of the behavior of some of them. There was a group of six. Sometimes they're just called the group of six, and it seems like a huge number of the monastic rules were composed after the group of six did something that was not really what monastics should do, but there was no rule against it, so the Buddha then quickly made a rule because of the group of six. And so you'd think, you know, the Buddha was supposed to be this great teacher that, you know, everyone would have been enlightened in his presence. But, you know, turns out people were people back then too. So, but there was this one conflict called the conflict at Kosambi, that town. And there was some very minor rule that may or may not have been broken by one monk. And maybe the modern equivalent would be if IRC had a rule that when you put the toilet paper on the toilet roll and against the wall, the flap that falls over the roll should be on the into the room, not back into the wall. So that's how serious this is. That, I mean, this is like major, right? So someone broke the rule that had to do, there was a monastic rule. Can you believe this monastic rule? That's, I mean, that's not, they didn't have toilet paper back then, but it's kind of related. Did he or did he not break the rule? And the monastery became divided around this topic. And they were at really odds and arguing, and no one could agree, and they were fighting. And the Buddha tried to step in to help them reconcile, and because reconciliation is such a beautiful value, find a way forward. But they kind of dismissed him. Imagine dismissing the Buddha, trying to help with a conflict. So anyway, so at some point or other, it got so out of hand. I forget exactly the details, so I want to be careful not to make it up here. But it got out of hand, and so at some point the Buddha gave teachings to them all, and maybe hoping that the teachings would get through to them. And the teachings go like this. The Buddha addressed the monastics thus. There are these six principles of cordiality that create love and respect and conduce to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. Isn't that a great list? So six principles that create love and respect. So I've been noticing how much in the suttas the word respect appears. And you don't, you know, if you read some book about, you know, the Wikipedia, teachings of the Buddha, I suspect you won't find a single reference to respect. Even whole big books about the, you know, the intricacies of the Buddha's teachings and emptiness and conditionality and enlightenment and all these wonderful things that we were interested in. There's no mention of respect, but you find salted pepper throughout the suttas, this idea of respect. Is it just incidental? There's no teachings about respect itself, like no definition of it. But respect. So for the monastics to live together with love, with care for each other, with respect for each other. To cohesion, with non-dispute, with concord and unity. Not an easy thing to do, but to hear this is the values that he sees that it's embodied in community. So this is the way you contribute to this. That's the teaching. This is how you contribute to this being possible. He's going to give six principles for this. And I'll read the first three together because they're almost the same. Here, a monastic maintains bodily acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards their companions in the holy life. This is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. And monastics maintain verbal acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, toward their companions in the holy life. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect, conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. And monastics maintain mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, toward their companions in the holy life. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect, to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. So I think it's kind of lovely. So this idea, maybe the word loving kindness is not the best translation for metta. In the recent years, I prefer goodwill. Loving kindness sometimes seems like a higher bar. That with goodwill, you know, I think I can have goodwill for people that I don't like. But if I don't like them, it's sometimes hard to love them. But it's not too hard to have goodwill. And so, you know, or some people are just challenging to be with, and you know, to have love with them seems like a wonderful ideal, but maybe a little bit too idealistic at times. But goodwill, I just find it such, to me, I find it so inspiring because it's more modest, more humble, more basic. So you have to have goodwill with each other. The word metta is related to the word friendliness, so it also could be translated as being friendly. And so what's interesting about this to me is if you want to contribute to a community that has these beautiful qualities, where there's love and respect as part of the community life, respect for each other, where there's some cohesion, some unity, some concord, take some responsibility for that. Offer your goodwill, both in public, you know, so that people see it. In private, I think means like in secrecy or, you know, behind people's backs. You know, you don't get any credit for it, but you're doing physical, verbal, and mental acts of goodwill. One of the little principles that I've come to appreciate, I don't know how, I guess if I make the statement too declaratively, it's maybe kind of superstitious, supernatural or superstitious or something, but I've come to understand that in social relationships, if I need something, if I feel like I need more love or respect or more people interested in me or whatever it might be, more that they want to, you know, I wish they were more generous or something, that if I feel like I have a need like that, rather than waiting for someone to give it, offer it first. Just offer it. Whatever you think you need, give it. And I find it's kind of magic. You know, it's a wonderful alchemy. And it's, I don't know if it's, you know, as I said, I don't know if that's universally a good idea, but I think that it's a powerful thing for our hearts, for our psychology, to have that experience of acknowledging we have a need. And something in the alchemy of the heart changes when we then turn around and have the agency, the empowerment, in a sense, to step up and offer it to someone else. And it's possible that the needs we have are more filled sometimes by offering it, because when we have needs from other people, people don't always behave. I don't know if you've noticed. And to get people to be just the way we want them to be is also problematic for all kinds of reasons. then one of them is not respectful for them. But to wait for someone to do something, to be how we want them to be, versus stepping forward and offering it, I think it does something really great for our hearts. In the teachings of the Buddha, one place where he says, in this translation, it says, make yourself a refuge for others. Actually, the Pali, literal Pali says, make yourself safe for others. So in this principle that I'm talking about now is that if you don't feel safe, help other people feel safe. And what happens to you when you take the initiative to create safety rather than waiting for safety to be handed to you, kind of? So here we have this goodwill, that you want to live in a community that there's goodwill. Offer goodwill privately and publicly. So that was the first three of the principles of cordiality. The next one is, monastics use things in common with their virtuous companions in the holy life. Without making reservations, they share with them any gain of a kind that accords with the Dhamma and has obtained in a way that accords with the Dhamma, including even the mere contents of their bowls, their begging bowls. So they use in common, means they share what they have. They don't, this idea of personal possessions is, in the monastic life is not something to be stuck on, but to share things and share what you have. Anything you've acquired ethically, dharmically, share it with your community. Even the smallest, even if you have just a little bit of content in your bowl, your alms bowl, and you have just a little bit of food, share your food with people. A very important experience in my life, that monastery I stayed in Thailand. It was the end of this wooden planks going across the swamp. And so you had to walk on the planks so you would sink in. And then there was up these little steps on this little 8x8 hut, because it was up on stilts above the swamp. So there were like three or four steps, and there was a teeny porch. And then there was a door and a little teeny little room. All I had in the room was a little bed. And I was late, I was not a Thai monastic, so when the monks would go out in the morning for their alms around to gather food, and I would stay behind and meditate in my room on my bed. And one day I finished my morning meditation and I opened my door and I saw that on my top of my steps was an apple and some cookies. And I looked up, down those plank of wood, and looked up, and there in the distance was a monk walking away. And he had left that for me. But what struck me about it was not that I'd received a gift. What struck me was that he was never going to know that I know he gave it to me. He gave it to me without any expectation that I would know and thank him or any kind of exchange. And that there was that generosity was done in that kind of way was so inspiring for me. It taught me something about giving without any stickiness, giving without expecting anything in return, just giving out of the pure joy and delight or care of giving. So here we have the Buddha emphasizing sharing in common with your others. So if you want a community where there's love and respect and concord and unity, share. Be generous is one of the principles. Then the fifth one, monastics dwell both in public and in private, possessing in common with their companions in the holy life those virtues that are unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmodeled, liberating, commended by the wise, not misapprehended, and conducive to concentration. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. So living an ethical life. And a few things that's interesting about this, you know, when we live ethically means we live in a way that we don't harm people. That's what I understand ethics to be. It says here, it's ethics is, not only is it ethical and not harming people, but it's also liberating. And here we see again this emphasis that a path to liberation and being ethical are kind of synonymous. The ethical maturation and maturation on the path to liberation are equal to each other, the same. In a way that oftentimes when people present Buddhist teachings, they say, oh, ethics is like the foundation. And you do ethics, then you go on to samadhi, then you go on to wisdom. But in the teachings of the Buddha, these are integrated, and the ethics grows and develops as people mature spiritually. And then, but also, is an interesting statement here about this: the ethics that leads to concord, love, and respect. It's also the behavior, the way to live, that is conducive to concentration. So, if you want to develop samadhi, live an ethical life. Be caring of others. Be careful with others, so that your life doesn't inadvertently cause harm. And to do it, it says, in public and in private. So do it so that both so people see it's being done, but also do it when no one sees you. There was some Western ethical philosopher who said something about real ethics is what you do in private when no one's watching. Because some people are very well-behaved publicly, but what they do privately is not always. People get away with all kinds of things, as you see in places where people can post anonymous messages. It's mean out there sometimes. And then we have one more principle of cordiality. Monastics dwell in public and in private, possessing in common with their companions in the holy life that view, that way of seeing, that is noble and emancipating, that leads one to who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect, and conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. So here, he's talking about, you know, complete liberation, and it has a role in our community life. It's beneficial. And so I imagine these monks who heard this, who were in dispute and arguing and not in unity, they dedicated their life to enlightenment. They dedicated their life to practice. And they probably hoped they realized then that, oh, I think we took the wrong turn. We're going down their path in the wrong direction if we stay in this conflict. So Sangha is not necessarily, or not usually, a perfect community where everyone is angels and enlightened beings that float on clouds, and every word and action they say is just completely going to make everyone just melt in love and delight and wonderful things. Community is hard. But how can we live in community of any type so that we are at ease, we feel safe, we feel settled. We can kind of, when we sit down to meditate, something inside of us can be released and let go and feel okay. I think it's a very, very important question. I don't think I have all the answers to that question. But I think some of it has to do with what we offer, how we show up. That if we could show up in some of these ways, for example, then I think something inside of us can relax. If we take a stand in kindness or goodwill, if we take a stand in generosity, if we take a stand in being ethical, we take a stand in a path that leads to liberation, in what way does that create the conditions that you can relax in your community life? A Buddhist Sangha, is meant to be a community of people who share some of the same values, as where they understand something about the path of liberation, that they're trying their best to be honest, to be true, to be mindful. And to me, that makes a world of difference, that in principle we have a shared purpose so that we can call on it. I don't know the way forward here now, but can we stop and be mindful of it? Can we agree to that at least? Can I be generous? Can I listen to others more deeply? Can I care for others? It doesn't seem like this community can do it all the time, but I think we're kind of on the same page. I think that, or if not on the same page, we're at least, you know, pages are next to each other. Maybe they're slow readers, but they'll catch up. It's the same book, so it's, you know, same plot, same conclusion. And so to take refuge, to find refuge, to go for refuge. Remember, the word is to go for refuge, which again is what we contribute, the going, the stepping forward. It's not waiting. It's not having magical thinking that somehow everything is going to be okay. But boy, it's a powerful to, I find in my life, to live in a practice in connection with other practitioners. I'm very confident, I know for 100% certainty, that I could not have practiced as much and as thoroughly as I did without the support of other practitioners around me. I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have had the fortitude, I wouldn't have had the guidance, I wouldn't have had the inspiration, I wouldn't have had the sense that it was possible, the encouragement to do so. And I've been out, you know, I've had enough contact outside of Buddhist communities to feel that for me there's a kind of a few different things I've experienced. One few is in some places a barrenness, where there's a kind of, I don't feel the atmosphere or the values of that Buddhism tends to offer. And it kind of feels kind of barren at times. And I've had the experience of being outside of Buddhist communities and met wonderful people who seem to be wiser and kinder than some us Buddhist friends. So, you know, when that was important for me to experience after I'd been some years in the monastery, because it was easy to start thinking that we were kind of special. But I was really impressed by these wonderfully mature, profound people who had nothing to do with Buddhism. But even so, this is where my life is in. And so, what do you have to contribute to creating Sangha? And what if what you had to contribute to creating Sangha, community, this refuge, you helped to create the refuge, that the means to do so is through being unagitated, being unanxious, being unhateful, being in some ways the medium is to be settled, to have a certain kind of peacefulness or calm or steadiness or what if that arises out of our ability to be centered, still, undistracted, not spinning out in our thoughts and preoccupations. And maybe you've had some taste in your life, maybe meditation, maybe other places in life, that would give you some sense of how a calm, steady sense of a heart at ease can be the medium, can be the means by which how we are kind, how we are generous, how we're ethical, can better travel out and support the world around us. Is there some way that giving yourself over to doing the practice of the retreat more thoroughly is your contribution to Sangha, to creating community? The Buddha said that one of the six principles of cordiality is to be on this path of liberation, of freedom. And so I leave you now at the end of the talk kind of with this question that I hope that you will answer with, not with words, but with your heart, with your body, with your inner life. Where's the door here? Where's the ease? Where's the calm that lives in you, that you can find in you, that moves to greater peace, that will benefit our world? I think that probably all of us have spent enough time thinking certain thoughts to begin to realize, I don't think this is the way forward. Keep thinking and thinking and thinking, fantasizing, remembering, planning. Maybe there's something waiting for you, a quieter place, a stiller place, a more centered place, a place where the attention has a steadiness, steady in the present moment, steady on your breathing. That makes for a more satisfying alternative than continuing in the highways and byways of the thinking, your thoughts and thinking. So that was my attempt to try to offer you some thoughts on the refuge and Sangha. A little bit with the idea that it's maybe setting the stage for Saturday talk on Not Self, but also the way of talking about Sangha that I hoped would not be agitating in the middle of the retreat, but maybe be a little inspiring to maybe give yourself over to this process you're on now. The idea that ethical maturation and the maturation on the path of liberation are really the same. If you give yourself over to really this practice, you'll become a gift for others. It's a beautiful thing. So to give yourself over these days, this is the chance here. You're in community. My Pandita, my teacher in Burma, he would make all kinds of teachings regularly about how phenomenally rare it is to have this many people together in one place at one time doing this kind of activity. It's one of the, it's really healthy what we're doing here. So enjoy it. Appreciate it. Love and respect each other. Love and respect yourself. And perhaps that'll support you. Something inside your heart can take a deep breath and go, oh, okay, here I am. No matter how difficult it is, here I am. I can sit, I can be with this, I can sit here and find the place. Where there's a path to peace. So, thank you very much.